From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of State of Belief listeners. That means you. You're listening now. We're very thankful for every one of you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on today's show.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists.
He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you.
There was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever.
What is it about the Donald? This guy reminds me of a carnival barker who is also fixated on being a bully. But a growing percentage of Republicans want him as leader of the free world. I want to tell you, I'm really looking forward to having this explained by one of the leading minds in the field of cognitive linguistics, author and educator, Professor George Lakoff, when he joins me once again on this week's show.
Some of the more distinctive Reconstructionist tropes include the notion of dominion, biblical law, the necessity of bringing every area of life under the lordship of Christ, focusing on biblically ordained institutions and sphere sovereignty.
There can be no denying that there are some leaders on the fringes of the Christian and political right who sincerely want to see this country and all of our lives run exclusively by their interpretation of biblical principles. For those who think none of this has any real impact, an eye-opening new book is required reading. It's titled Building God's Kingdom Inside the World of Christian Reconstruction. And on this week's show, I'll welcome the author, Dr. Julie Ingersoll, back to State of Belief Radio. But first,
President Barack Obama is calling civil rights leader Julian Bond a hero who helped change the country for the better. Bond died Saturday in Florida.
Last Saturday, a crucial voice in the civil rights movement was silenced when activist Julian Bond passed away at the age of 75. While still in college, Julian helped establish the profoundly influential Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. After years of hands-on activism, he served numerous terms in the Georgia State Legislature, then taught at several universities. Julian was also the first president of the Southern Poverty Law Center and served a term as chairman of the NAACP. Through it all, Julian brought a clarity of vision and a moral authority that led to his courageously linking the struggle for African-American civil rights and LGBT civil rights early and often, despite the loud disagreement of others. Joining me right now to help us remember the man behind all of these achievements is the Reverend Dr. Amos C. Brown, a lifelong civil rights champion in his own right, who knew Julian Bond well. Amos, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for the opportunity of sharing with you and your audience again.
Amos, when I say the words Julian Bond, what immediately comes to your mind?
He is a quintessential expression of one who was part of the talented tent, the black community, who did not fail to keep his responsibility of working to lift up the masses of African Americans and all people of marginalized status in this country being respected and included as citizens and individuals with worth and dignity.
When did you first meet Julian Bond?
I met him first in 1959 at Morehouse. We came from a similar social orbit of civil rights activism. Julian was destined to be a fighter for civil rights and human rights because in his home, his father surrounded him with some of the brightest, most resourceful statespersons who fought for human dignity and civil rights.
Of all of his many achievements, Which do you feel were the most important to Julian Bond himself?
I feel his being a historian and a narrator of the struggle. Julian was an outstanding writer, a prolific writer also. He was very articulate and quite a gentleman, too. Hmm. I feel that young people today need to look to his model, his mannerisms, as they go about even dealing with Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm.
Julian was not bombastic. He was very forthright. He was very strong, but he was able to state his case in a very respectful manner.
Amos, if you ask Julian to list the priorities, what was at the top of his list of important things to get done?
I think number one is to get people to be world citizens and not live in a silo and come out of this thinking of them against us, us against them.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. Number two, Julian felt that for this country, voting rights is very important. For that's the only way you can impact public policy, through electing persons to office who are supportive of your interests. Education is very important for him.
Mm-hmm.
He was a teacher at the University of Virginia and a number of other schools as guest lecturer and adjunct professor.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say number three, there would be economic empowerment. For he knew so well that we did not get our 40 acres and our mule, which destroyed the economic base of the Black community.
Mm-hmm.
And if we had gotten our 40 acres and mule, we would not have been thrown into the penal system of sharecropping, mm-hmm. which he witnessed in the Mississippi Delta. You know, Julian was involved during the summer of 1964 in Mississippi with Marion Wright Elderman. And they were working in those impoverished areas, trying to enfranchise Blacks there and also to get better opportunity programs going for them. It was on the cusp of the summer of 64 that President Johnson inaugurated the poverty program later.
Mm-hmm.
But Marion Wright Elderman and other students, along with Julian, were the ones who were agitating for the world to know about the horrible social and economic conditions that Blacks were living in places like Sugar Ridge, Mississippi. So those are the things that he was very passionate about.
Yeah. Were there aspects of the civil rights movement that you think frustrated Julian?
Yes, and the final one was marriage equality. Julian and I were one of the students
mm-hmm.
who sat at the feet of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. at Morehouse, semesters in 1961-62.
Mm-hmm.
And we took a course in social philosophy. And in that course, Dr. King expounded Brightman's idea of personalism. That is, every person is important, of worth and dignity, and should be respected. So when the issue came up of gay rights and marriage equality, Julian was frustrated that, unfortunately, a number of members of the National Board of NAACP were very cool toward him when he spoke about gay rights being equated with civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
But he said it was hypocritical to talk about Black people getting their rights under the 14th Amendment, that equal protection under the law. And then you turn around and deny gays their right to be who they are and to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Hmm.
So that in 2008, at the board meeting in Miami, Florida, when Alice Huffman, William Barber, and I'm the one who made the motion that NAACP would support marriage equality under the equal protection under the law. When the vote was taken, there were only two dissenters. And Julian said himself, wow, you all did something today that I didn't think that you were prepared to do. You really surprised me. So I think that that was frustrating for him, and he considered it a major contradiction for black civil rights workers to be against gay rights when they had to fight for their rights. And he made it very clear there's a difference between R-I-T-E-S, rights, in a religious faith context, and civil rights that everyone in this nation should have.
Amos, right now, we are seeing increased awareness of inequalities between white and black America. The Black Lives Matter movement is getting a lot of attention. Political candidates are being challenged to address issues of race. In your mind, what are the lessons that today's activists must learn from the lifetime work of Julian Bond?
I think it's first must understand that the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yes.
And they're fighting the same struggles that we fought in our day. And until human beings get it in their hearts, in their minds, that everyone is to be respected, we will have this problem of racism, bigotry, and injustice. And that's why we have to understand that eternal vigilance is the price of success.
Yes.
And the young people today cannot chill. They cannot hang out. They got to be aware. They got to do their homework. For example, when we sat down in Atlanta, 1960, we were hooking up with a movement that had already been birthed by the NAACP Youth Council going back to August 28, 1958. When youth units of NAACP sat down in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, Wichita, Kansas, and Louisville, Kentucky, there's been a misstatement of the student movement. The movement did not start in Greensboro in 1960. It started in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, in 1958. But before we sat down in Atlanta, the college presidents of those historically black schools called us into conference room at Harkness Hall and said, young people, we don't want to get in your way. We won't stop you from fighting for your rights. But at least let the world know why you're doing what you are doing. And they suggested that we would have a committee craft a document. And from that suggestion, they took the document and had it published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And after we finished the document and was published, then we sat down and broke down segregation encounters in Atlanta. And later we led wade-ins in Savannah, Georgia, kneel-ins, even at White First Baptist. Students at Morehouse and Spelman and were literally thrown out of that church back in 1962. But I wish to share with the audience from Maren Wright Edelman's book, Lanterns, her memoirs, just one paragraph. It says here, we are all in the air about sit-down protests now. And I'm sick and tired of our inactivity. A group of us have been planning, led by Lonnie King, an able and sincere person who's backed by the Kings, that's Martin Luther King Jr.'s family. And this goes on to say, Julian Bond, Morris Dillard, Amos Brown, bright young NAACPL. I was the youngest person in the conference. Melvin McCall and Ed Harper are our caucus. And it was from that caucus, March 4, 1960, that students laid the foundation for what became the Committee on Appeal for Human Rights. Notice our entry was broad. We didn't just talk about civil rights. That document that one can get off the internet now. It's called An Appeal on Human Rights. It was published, and the rest is history. And that's why, Mr. Bond, be concerned about the freedoms, the rights of all persons, including persons who are gay, transgender, or bisexual, because we got it at Morehouse.
Do you have one favorite memory of Julian Bond that you could share with us?
Yes. In Washington, D.C., on occasion of the dedication of Martin Luther King Memorial, it was 2011 in August, the civil rights workers of yesteryear were to bring remarks, and Martin Luther King's son, Martin the Third, and several others were speakers. And I was listed in the group who spoke of hope. And in my segment, there was Julian Bond, William H. Gray, Dorothy Cotton, and Amos Brown. And after I finished, and I had just come out of the experience of having a stroke in 2010, the audience responded in an amazing way. And when I came down from the podium, Julian was there. And he said to a group that was gathered there, "I don't care what you say, Amos gave the speech today." It wasn't just a matter of my ego, but I think what Julian was saying, when I expressed what we learned in Dr. King's class at Morehouse, students, and applied it to the present circumstance, he felt that I did a good job that Dr. King would have been proud of.
The Reverend Dr. Amos C. Brown is pastor of Third Baptist Church of San Francisco. Dr. Brown is a lifelong leader in the civil rights movement and the longtime president of the San Francisco branch of the NAACP. Amos, I really want to thank you for being with us today as we remember the incredible legacy of civil rights hero Julian Bond, who passed away last Saturday at the age of 75. Thank you, Amos.
Thank you very much.
Sure, it's ridiculously early in the presidential campaign cycle, but the race is getting plenty of attention, and there's no bigger story than the seemingly unstoppable rise of real estate mogul and reality TV star Donald Trump. When something in American politics or culture just doesn't seem to make any sense, the one man I know I can turn to for an explanation is best-selling author and professor of cognitive linguistics, Professor George Lakoff, known as the father of framing. And so I'm very happy to be able to welcome him back to State of Belief Radio. George, we need you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure, as always.
I think a lot of us would be prone to dismissing the Trump phenomenon as a sideshow during the silly season at best, or an indictment of our media and some voters at worst. You have a different take?
I sure do. Let's start with what conservatism and progressive thought are about. The best way to understand this is in terms of family structure. That is, if you're a progressive and you're raising a family, you have, let's say, two parents, and they are of equal authority. Their job is to empathize with their kids, to know what all those dreams and problems mean, to talk with them openly so they know what's going on with their children, and to take care of them and to take care of themselves so they can take care of their children, and to raise their children in the same way, to empathize with other people, to put themselves in other people's shoes, to take care of themselves as well as other people and to think about them and to function socially well in their lives and to be fulfilled in their lives. You want your children to be fulfilled in their lives just as you want to be fulfilled in yours. That's what it means to be a progressive parent. Now, if you're a strict father parent, and it's usually a father, though it could be a mother, a strict father has authority, period. And in a strict father family, the authority cannot be questioned. That's a very big deal. That is, the strict father's spouse and children have to listen to what he says. The assumption is he knows right from wrong. He knows the right thing to do, and what he says is what's right. And that if children, or possibly a spouse, disagrees with them, the children, they get punished. And the punishment is often physical punishment. That's one way to engage in punishment, so that the children want to avoid being punished physically, disciplined in that way, and so will do what the father says, and that's the way to have the children become disciplined. And if they become disciplined, they can go out into the world and earn a living. And what happens if they're poor and not earning a living? That means they're not disciplined, and they're therefore can't be moral. They can't do the right thing. And going along with that view is a view of what I call the moral hierarchy. That is, the assumption is that the people who should rule, who are in charge, are the people who are more moral. How do you tell? Well, in a well-run world, run by God, from that point of view, you say, okay, look at what's happened over history. You have a moral hierarchy, God above man, man above nature. We are conquering nature, conquering animals, etc., conquering the world. Two, adults above children, certainly, and then Western culture above other cultures, you know, our country above other countries, and then things like men above women, whites above non-whites, Christians above non-Christians, straights above gays, okay? So you have a kind of moral hierarchy that is set in place. And the first part of the hierarchy, before you get down to men above women, et cetera, is very common conservative thought. You know, not all conservatives believe it's men above women or straights above gays, but it's a very common thing that you find, that when you find these kinds of views, they often go along with certain conservative views, especially in public policy. Now, when you understand that, think about what an abusive strict father does. An abusive strict father simply says, I'm in charge, period, out there. No question about it. You're doing what I'm saying or else. That's Donald Trump.
Yeah, you're right.
No apologies.
Is he smart enough to be aware of what he's doing and why that's working? I always thought he was just shooting from the hip.
Well, he has a natural understanding of it. Good political leaders don't have an intellectual understanding of it. They are natural, quote-unquote, leaders. And notice that a lot of people who are following Trump are not wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
They are poor conservatives who are strict fathers at home.
Yeah.
Who want to have authority, at least in their home or their community or, you know, wherever they are in whatever part of life, and they want to be able to assert it clearly. I have this authority, whether it's a gun owner
mm-hmm.
or a business owner or whatever.
Hmm.
And that's Donald Trump. He's right out there. I have this authority. I can fire you. You're fired. You don't do what I like and make me richer. You're fired, period. The problem with this is that the people in the media do not understand him at all.
Explain to our listeners and to me how even the very narrowest of evangelicals can hear some of the, at least not anti-religious, but certainly not very religious comments that Trump has made, and they tend to be very strict in protecting morals, and yet they are stepping forward to support Trump. How does that happen?
Very straightforward. What counts as morality in both cases? Let's start with progressive religion. You see that with the Pope coming out, not just about climate change, but changing the idea of Catholicism. You know, if you actually read what Pope Francis says in his encyclical, he says we have to change our understanding of the Trinity. God is the source of all life. Jesus is the recipient of all life. And the Holy Spirit is the love that connects them and makes life possible. That's a progressive view of religion. It's not the traditional view, and there's nothing in there about individual salvation.
Mm-hmm.
This is about human salvation. Now, when you take progressive religion, where you say God is a nurturing parent,
mm-hmm.
that straight on, if you, a good example of that is Obama's speech in Charleston and the idea of the Methodist AME church members, you know, who were forgiving and who say, look, we're here to help people. We're here to empathize with people. If you say, what is grace?
Mm-hmm.
Grace is God's nurturance. God's taking care of you. You have to be close to God to get grace. You can't earn grace. It has to be given to you. It's a gift
mm-hmm.
that heals you, that makes you whole, that makes you strong, and that makes you a good person.
Yeah.
That is nurturance.
Mm-hmm.
It's God's nurturance. That's what grace is about. And what Obama was doing was saying that evangelical Christianity has two parts. The black church in Charleston was evangelical in a certain sense in terms of a community and singing and things like that. But in terms of the way they viewed God, it was God as a nurturer.
Mm. Yeah.
Now, the right-wing evangelicals view God as a strict father. Here's my laws. You put them down. You follow them. You get into heaven. You don't. You go to hell. Punishment.
Hmm.
Eternal.
Yeah.
But Donald Trump. I mean, it's just, God is strict father. Donald Trump is strict father.
Hmm. My guest is Professor George Lakoff, best-selling author and a leading theoretician in cognitive linguistics. Okay, I want to turn to the Democrats because they've got a lot of stuff going on there as well that we need you to help us understand.
Let's start with Bernie Sanders.
Okay.
Bernie, from the point of view of progressives, he's like a one-trick pony. It's all about income inequality, period.
Uh-huh.
And he's very good on that. He says, yes, there is income inequality. It's unfair. It's not right. We need to change the following things. Everybody should be able to go to college. There should be a higher minimum wage. People should be paid for the work they do. Men and women should get wage equality, et cetera. And he's talking always about economics and particular individual policies, one by one, with no idea how to pay for any of them and no idea what connects them and no idea really about environmentalism, about foreign policy, about global economy, about anything at all beyond that. But there is something else. He is honest. He's straightforward. It's very clear who he is. He says what he believes, and that's important. He's not trying to be, quote-unquote, political in the sense of pulling the wool over people's eyes, etc. And that gets a certain amount of progressive support because those are part of progressive values. However, the real part of progressive values, namely the totality of it, isn't there with Bernie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Hillary has done some things right and some things not right. What she's done right is to base her campaign around caring. Her campaign announcement was videos of people caring about each other. Happy families where parents were taking care of children, where people were taking care of the aged, was one after another about the kind of individual view of care that is necessary to understand progressive thought.
Mm-hmm.
Second announcement was this. She goes to Iowa and she sets up meetings in cafes, but with people who are doing caring things, who have issues about caring. And then she listens to them until they tell their stories about caring, about progressive thought.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, yes, and not only that, we can put it into legislation this way, and we can put it into legislation that way, and we can do it through government in this way, right?
Right.
Very clever, very smart. And then Donald Trump comes and takes over the media, for all the conservative values right out there.
Hmm. Tell our listeners what Reframe America is all about, who it's for, what changes you want to see come from that.
It has to do with you want people to be able to be trained on how to think and talk in terms of progressive issues that people don't think and talk about normally. Mm-hmm. For example, suppose you think about work from the point of view of working people. Then someone who is working is a profit creator. The other guys say, well, they're really job creators, but mainly they only hire people if they create profit for them. If you're a profit creator, you deserve parts of the profit. What is a pension? A pension is delayed payment for work already done. If they cut your pensions, they're stealing your money. Mm-hmm. If they cut your benefits, they're cutting your salary. This is a very important thing to say. There's another very important thing to say, which is democracy in America has always been based on the idea that citizens care about other citizens, work through the government to provide public resources for everybody, like roads, you know, airports, the internet, the satellite system that supports all GPSs and so on. You know, all the things that government does, public education, public health, you can't run a business if you don't have roads, if you don't have a computer, if you don't have educated people, if you don't have health, you know, if you don't have sewers, you can't run a business. You can't have a decent private life. So the idea is the private depends on the public. It's not being said. Our job is to say, okay, let's say these things out loud and get an idea of what progressive thought is like from the point of view of what we've talked about, nurturance and caring, to get a form of discourse out there and to train people in it. One area of training is via the internet. Mm-hmm. Another area of training is through institutions. So one thing we can do is offer trainings for an institution that has communication specialists and trainers themselves to help train the communication specialists to say things in communications that support each other. Mm-hmm. Now, the important part of this is what we call intermediate structures. Between the nurturant moral system and any individual issue, there are hundreds of individual issues, form classes of issues, like thinking of work from the point of view of working people, or the private depends on the public. And when you talk in terms of ultimate moral values, nurturant values, and intermediate values, like the private depends on the public and so on, what you're doing with your individual issue is you're supporting all the other progressive issues. And the idea is to get a way in which talking about these things supports the issues as a whole. The conservatives already do this when they say government is the problem. It goes through all of the issues. What the conservatives want to do is get rid of public resources.
Yeah. I know our listeners will be interested in this new initiative. How can they stay in touch with that, find out more information about Reframe America?
Very simple. Just go to ReframeAmerica, all one word, .com, and it's all there. The information is right there, ReframeAmerica.com. And there's a book. I've rewritten Don't Think of an Elephant. So there's a book called The All New Don't Think of an Elephant. Retail, $12. You know, it's short. It's easy to read. You can put it in your pocket. It's out there. And, you know, if you have an organization, you can get big discounts on the books. We're trying to sell them cheaply and get them in people's hands easily.
George Lakoff is professor of cognitive linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley. George, I really hope we can come back to you as the campaign progresses, because there is absolutely nobody else analyzing this stuff the way you do, and we always benefit from hearing from you. So thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Always a pleasure, Weldon.
Christian Reconstructionism is a philosophy of biblical dominance that is so extreme that it's easy to dismiss as utterly incompatible with our pluralistic, secular, high-tech society. That is, until you learn to recognize its teachings and its objectives as they make their way into more mainstream rhetoric. An outstanding history of the movement has just come out in the form of a new book by Dr. Julie Ingersoll. The title is Building God's Kingdom Inside the World of Christian Reconstructionism. And I am grateful to have the author joining me right now on State of Belief Radio. Julie, welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's great to be back.
One of the worst things an interviewer can do to an author is ask her to boil down years and years of work into a brief definition. But I can guarantee we have some listeners who are not familiar with Christian Reconstructionism at all. So, Judy, I have to ask you, please, to do a brief definition to get us started.
Christian Reconstructionists are a kind of Reformed Calvinist Christian. Their origins date to the early 1960s and a writer named R.J. Rushdoony. The most important component of what they've done is to make an argument for applying the Bible as they read it to every aspect of life. And your listeners may actually have encountered references to them in various publications, because occasionally they do sort of make their way into newspaper articles and magazine articles and the like. But often it's because Rushdoony said some very inflammatory things, and usually all that people hear about him are those things. And so it's easy for people to think that this movement isn't particularly relevant, because if you only know the really inflammatory things, then it doesn't seem possible that they could have had any influence. The book argues that there's more influence than people recognize.
Julie, they apply the Bible as they read it. What does as they read it mean?
Well, that's a really great question, because a lot of times when people who are sort of mainstream modern Christians encounter these folks, it's really hard for people to get their head around how it is that they're reading the Bible in the way that they are. I think one of the first most important things to recognize is they take a notion from the Reformation about the unity of Scripture, mm-hmm. and they see the Hebrew Bible / Old Testament and the New Testament as one sacred text. There's modern Christians often make a break, and they say, oh, well, that was the Old Testament, and we live in New Testament times. And they actually often think there's a radical discontinuity in history with regard to Old Testament and New Testament. But Christian Reconstructionists, and they're tapping into a longstanding tradition as part of the Protestant Reformation, believe that the entirety of the Bible, the Old and New Testaments, are still relevant. Hmm. So when they read the Bible to think about how to apply it to life, they start with the Old Testament. That's some of the inflammatory things.
So when we hear about dominionism, is that just another word for Christian Reconstruction?
It is actually a key component of how Reconstructionists think that the world should be transformed according to biblical law. Mm-hmm. So they think that God made Adam and Eve in Genesis for a particular purpose, that was dominion. The fall ruined that, and that with the resurrection, Jesus restored humanity to its original purpose, which is the exercise of dominion.
Hmm.
So when you do read in the newspaper or in magazines about dominionism, that is a theological perspective that traces back to this movement.
What other movements overtly connect to this? For example, the Quiverful model of family, is that related to Reconstructionism?
Yeah, I think that one really is. Much of the promotion of it was out of an organization in Texas that actually doesn't exist anymore, and it was called Vision Forum. They actually developed and promoted this very specific notion of what they call biblical patriarchy or the Quiverful movement. So that's absolutely a movement that is closely identified with Christian Reconstructionists. But even more broadly, movements where people wouldn't necessarily realize the degree to which their perspective is rooted in Rushdoony. Starting in the 60s and 70s, Reconstructionists, well, Rushdoony specifically, made an argument that public education is inherently unbiblical, mm-hmm. and that Christians needed to pull their children out of public schools. And initially it was to put them in Christian schools, but sometimes they ran afoul of truancy laws. And Rushdoony successfully argued in the court that the right to choose a religiously based education for your children is actually a First Amendment protected right.
Mm-hmm.
And so he actually helped lay the early philosophical groundwork for this movement that we call Christian education, and he was involved in much of the early curriculum development for that and for establishing a legal structure where it was protected. One of his followers, Gary DeMar, has an organization outside Atlanta called American Vision, and he's been very involved in Tea Party stuff from the first, from really early 2009. They do those study cruises where they have a variety of Tea Party leaders, people from World Net Daily. You know, they do these Tea Party-oriented study cruises where he's one of the speakers and one of the organizers. So there are places where Rush G followers are out advocating certain kinds of reform. They definitely argue for the dismantling of public education.
Yeah.
They argue for the transformation of correctional facilities and prison systems to privatization. There is an entire view of economics that they understand to be rooted in the Bible. They call it biblical economics. And it's kind of classic libertarian, so it's very much that form of economics, but they work tirelessly to promote that stuff.
Julie, when we hear presidential candidates like Mike Huckabee or Rick Santorum talking about putting God first, putting the Bible first, are they espousing Reconstructionism, or does it just all sound similar?
I think it's more complicated than that, because it's not just in the notion of putting God first. It's how they understand putting God first. And I think Rustini's had a lot to do with that. David Barton is a great example of this. He is, you know, also from Texas. Fancies himself a historian, although he has no such credentials. But he's been very involved with Glenn Beck and the radio and television shows that Beck has had over the years. And he has also been involved in presidential campaigns, not just in this round, but previously. And so, for example, people like Santorum and people like Michelle Bachmann, those folks have drawn on Barton's understanding of applying the Bible to everyday life. And that understanding is very much what was framed by Rush Dooney.
I see. Have there been peaks and valleys in how much influence these thoughts have had on the history of our nation? And are the advocates, the Reconstructionists themselves, do they tend to be a part of other churches and speaking there, or do they go into one fellowship so they can be together? I'm just trying to get a feel of how that actually gets a foothold and how it spreads.
Well, there's a couple of denominations that have some core groups of Reconstructionists in them, and sometimes that's clearly quite a point of contention inside the denomination. So if I were going to drop into a community I didn't know and I wanted to go do a little more field research and I wanted to say, I wonder if there are any Reconstructionists here, I might look for a couple of different kinds of churches, typically Presbyterian, but not the PCUSA, not the big mainline one, the smaller ones like the Orthodox Presbyterian Church or the Presbyterian Church in America. Those are more strongly Calvinist, and so Reconstructionists are often drawn to them. That's not to say that everyone in those denominations is Reconstructionist. In fact, they often have little faction battles inside the churches because some people like the Christian Reconstructionist interpretation of Calvinism and other people do not. But so you find them in some kinds of strongly Reformed, Protestant, often Presbyterian kinds of churches. You can often find them in other kinds of denominations where the church doesn't necessarily agree with them, but they sort of see it as their mission to provide books and spread the word and all of that. There is additionally an interesting organization called the National Center for Family Integrated Churches. And you can go on the web and look at them. They have thousands of affiliated churches, and you don't have to necessarily agree with everything that Reconstructionists believe to become an affiliated church, but you have to buy a lot of it. And when you're when you spend time around them, I think you sort of imbue some of it just kind of by osmosis. So, you know, you might not be inclined to talk about Dominion, but you might be really interested in this idea of not dividing families up in church and sending the kids off to Sunday school. So, so say you're a pastor, you join the family integrated church movement. Oh, but wait a minute, the women who are on our board of elders now, they can't be there anymore. So that has to start dropping off. And yeah, you know, that Dominion language is kind of interesting. So it just sort of permeates. So, you know, after a while, people are all homeschooling their kids. And the ideas spread, I think, in ad hoc, subtle kinds of ways. But I don't think that that should surprise us. We think that people buy a whole agenda, and they think, oh, well, they have to be consistent, so they take the whole idea. But I don't think that that's actually how it really works. Mm-hmm. You know, and most people are not aware of the variety of influences in how they see the world. Mm-hmm. You know, Christians, they're not cognizant of how much Plato influenced the early church. What were the philosophical influences on Augustine that shaped the traditions in Christianity? Other people don't know that. So I think a lot of the places where Rushdie's influence is evident, I think when you have to be pretty conversant with him to be able to hear it.
Julie, how influential is this movement, and is the influence of the movement strong enough that we ought to be concerned about it?
Well, I'm concerned about efforts to completely unravel public education, and I think that that traces back to Rushdie. I don't think that that means that there's a almost successful conspiracy that's going to, you know, kind of storm into the White House and the Congress and take over the government. I don't think that. But I think that some of their positions that I find troubling, and particularly, you know, as an educator, public education is important to me. Mm-hmm. And, we see across the country a kind of broad-based transformation in people's attitudes about public education, mm-hmm. their support for public education. And I think that that's rooted in part in the work of these folks. It's not exclusively theirs. I'm not saying that. I just think that they've played a role in it in a way that we haven't really paid attention to. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Julie Ingersoll is professor of religious studies at the University of North Florida in Jacksonville. Her important new book is titled Building God's Kingdom Inside the World of Christian Reconstruction. Julie, I really appreciate you being with us and what you've done.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Well, that's all the time there is for this week's show. Oh, I liked this one a whole lot. I hope you did, too. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a very sincere thank you. The ongoing financial support of our listeners is essential to keeping the show on the air. If you find value in what you're hearing, and if you think it's important that more people hear what you're hearing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and find links mentioned during the show. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And share the stories you find compelling with your friends. We really need you to help spread the word about us and this show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.